Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Gnati Minandyasya Gnanan Gnashalakaya Chakshuran Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Mukam Kroti Bachalam Pangam Langaya Tegrim Yat Kripatadaham Bande Shri Gurun Dinataranam. So today is the March 23rd class of the seminar on the Srimad Bhagavatam as the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And in today's class, we shall be looking at the philosophy of Buddhism. And this examination of Buddhism and its refutation from Srimad Bhagavatam will also carry over until the next class, which is not tomorrow, because tomorrow is Ekadasi. The day after tomorrow, March 25th, we shall continue our examination of this topic. So, by way of introduction, as you know, Lord Buddha is an incarnation of Krishna, who came for a particular purpose, to stop animal slaughter, which was being performed in the name of Vedic injunctions. In the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Vedic priests, they lost their potency to promote sacrificed animals, to promote their souls to a higher station. There are mantras in the Vedas which are to be chanted by the priests, which rejuvenate the animals that are sacrificed, so that the animals get a new body. Even there are mantras which can promote the souls of these sacrificed animals to heaven. So with the beginning of Kali Yuga, these Brahmins had lost that potency. So their chanting of these mantras was ineffective. So consequently, these Vedic ritualistic sacrifices were nothing more than animal slaughter. So this is very sinful, and it pained Lord Krishna to see that in the name of the Vedic scriptures, which he gave in order to deliver living entities from sinful life. So in the name of Vedic literature, sinful life was being propagated. So therefore, taking great compassion upon the innocent animals, he descended about 2,500 years ago as the Buddha Deva. And Lord Buddha's purpose was to stop this animal sacrifice by rejecting the Vedic scriptures and establishing his own dharma, a dharma of ahimsa, non-violence. So actually, Lord Buddha's teachings were very basic. Lord Buddha, as Buddhists themselves admit, was not fond of speculative philosophy. He came to teach a path by which mankind could become free of sin and suffering. So when Buddha was asked, for instance, one philosopher came to Buddha and asked him, "I've heard your lectures, and sometimes you seem to indicate that there is a soul. Sometimes you seem to indicate that there is not a soul. Sometimes you seem to indicate that the universe is real. Sometimes you seem to indicate that it is not real. I hear so many contradictions in your different lectures about what is the ultimate nature of things. So can you please tell me, is there a soul, is there not a soul? Bodhu is actually silent. He didn't answer. Because he didn't want to become involved in speculation. And his answer to such questions, when he did give it, was simply another example. Actually, someone else asked a similar question, and Lord Buddha gave this example of the arrow. When one is hit by an arrow, and the arrow is stuck in your body and you're bleeding, then do you ask, oh, where did this arrow come from? How fast was it traveling when it hit my body? Who fired this arrow? No. You have the arrow removed and you get your body healed. So Lord Buddha said, this is my mission. So, therefore, the very essential questions, especially what is the most essential question of philosophy, as we've been hearing over the last days, that is, what is the cause? This essential question and other very important questions are neglected in Lord Buddha's teachings. He did not bother to touch on them. Actually, he termed such questions as avyakrita. Avyakrita means these are not to be discussed. Inexpressible. So, therefore, there are many points of philosophy which are called in Buddhist thinking avyakrita vastuni. We just don't touch on these things. But then when the Buddhist philosophers were challenged, because Buddhism began to spread through India, especially when it won the patronage of Maharaj Ashok. So Buddhist philosophy was challenged by other philosophers who were following the Vedic tradition, for instance, the Sankhya philosophers and so on, Karma Mimamsa. So the Buddhists therefore had to come up with some answers. So therefore different schools of Buddhism arose. So first of all, let us talk about what essentially is Buddhist philosophy. And then we'll look at the Buddhist schools. So essentially Buddhist philosophy consists of four principles, or the so-called fourfold noble truths. And these are, first of all, dukkha. So I think most, if not all of you, know what this word means. Dukkha means suffering. So the first principle of Buddhism is that there is suffering. Suffering exists. Or existence means suffering. Or that which we call reality. It is simply suffering. And hetu is the second principle. Hetu means there is a cause of this suffering. Now, what is the cause of suffering? Well, in Buddhism, it's simply that you exist. This world exists as a place of suffering, and because you exist in it, therefore you suffer. So, then if there is a cause to suffering, which is existence, then that means there must be a way of negating suffering, and that is nirodha. Nirodha means annihilation, extinction. This is the way you solve the problems of life. You extinguish yourself, cease to exist. And how do I extinguish the self? Do I just put a gun against my head and pull the trigger? No, no, no. Therefore, the fourth principle is marga. There is a path given by the Buddha by which you can attain nirvana. And this path is known as the Eightfold Noble Paths. It consists of 8 steps. But these have been condensed by Buddhist philosophers into 2. And I put them here, Ahimsa and Shunyata. Ahimsa means, of course, non-violence. So why are we suffering in this world? Because this world is a world of violence. Everyone is doing harm to others. All, as Bhagavatam also says, jivasya jiva jivanam. To live in this world means to live at the expense of other jivas. In order for me to live, to survive, I must eat the bodies of other living entities, whether vegetable or animal. But I must live at their expense. In fact, every step I take in this world is causing harm to other living beings. So, this is the reason for suffering. So, therefore, I should practice ahimsa, non-violence. And ultimate ahimsa means shunyata. Shunyata means to cease to exist. Shunya means void. So I become perfect in ahimsa when I simply cease all activity, cease to be. So these are out of this Eightfold Noble Path. These are the essences, ahimsa and shunyata. So now the Buddhist schools came about, as I said, in struggling with the question, what is the cause? Dukkha, everything is suffering. But why? What is the cause of that? Well, the first school of Buddhists, who are known as Shotrantika, they're known in Western terms, in terms of Western philosophy, as direct realists. That means they just accept everything as it is. Everything is full of suffering because that's the way it is. But that's not a very satisfactory answer as to the cause. So there was a later group of philosophers known as representationalists, which simply means that the mind, there is something out there, but the mind is representing it within. And that representation is wrong. Therefore, we have to correct that. So the second school admitted that there is matter outside and there is mind within. And the problem is this mind. This mind has to be adjusted correctly to deal with the outside world. But that also did not satisfy everyone. So then a later school came out called the Vijnanavada school or Yogacharya. Subjective idealists. They said everything is mind only. There is a term in Western philosophy, solipsism. This means you think I'm the only one who exists. Everything is just my own mind. But then the question is, if everything is just the product of my own mind, then why do I will myself to suffer? You see, you still can't get around this question, why is there suffering? So if everything is just my own mind, then why don't I say, all right, I think everything is nice, and then everything should be nice. It doesn't work that way. So what we're seeing here is a progression of frustration, as is seen also in Western philosophy. This is why I bothered to put these Buddhist schools up here on the board, with their Western equivalents, Western philosophical equivalents. Because the appearance of these Buddhist schools actually marks the same progress of thinking, or maybe we should say degradation of thinking rather than progress. Progress of thinking in atheistic Western philosophy. First of all, Western philosophers started off thinking everything is the way it is. And then they realized, but that doesn't explain suffering. So then they came up with the duality of mind and matter. But that also wasn't satisfactory. So everything is mind only. become completely subjective. And then finally, what is the last stage? Voidism. A total frustration. So, we don't have time to get into the correlation between these Buddhist schools and Western philosophical schools, but there is a very, very marked similarity. If you read Srila Prabhupada, that book, Dialectical Spiritualism, Srila Prabhupada's answers to Western philosophy, you trace out the history of Western philosophy from that book, and you'll see the same pattern. So, as I've indicated previously, what we're actually seeing here, it's not really philosophy, it's just psychology. The psychology of frustration. So therefore, Buddhist so-called philosophy is really just the mind at work. It's just the mental plane. It's not really philosophy at all. It's just the mind going through its phases of, first of all, trying to accept the world as real and interact with it, becoming frustrated. Then there's some problem between mind and the world. And then the mind tries to completely take over everything by saying, everything is only mind. And then finally becoming totally frustrated, everything is zero, nothing. So tomorrow we'll be looking more at these ideas that everything is mind and everything is nothing. These ideas are very prominent in the West today. So I want to spend tomorrow to examine these carefully and refute them from Srimad Bhagavatam. But today, we're going to be looking at some basic principles of the Buddhist philosophy, which is more or less accepted, these principles are more or less accepted by all Buddhist schools. So, first of all, we'll look at the question of dukkha, suffering. Why is there suffering? The Buddhists don't really have an explanation for that. Buddha just said there is suffering, dukkha. That's the way things are. But Srimad Bhagavatam explains why there is suffering. First of all, Srimad Bhagavatam informs us that suffering is not the ultimate reality. This is the unfortunate conclusion of Buddhism, that the ultimate state of things is suffering. And the only thing you can do about that is negate yourself. You have to just cease to exist. Existence means suffering. So if you want to get out of suffering, then you have to cease to exist. Which is actually not a very pleasant alternative. It's rather hard to comprehend that. That this will be my final state, non-existence. And this non-existence, you must understand, in Buddhism it is absolute. It is not that you're existing but without perception of pain, without perception of name, form, quality. No, you don't exist anywhere. You're just not there anymore. That's the Buddhist conclusion. So this is not very attractive, except for, as I said, people who are totally frustrated, totally finished, then this philosophy would appeal to them. So, but Srimad Bhagavatam says the natural state of affairs is ananda, full of bliss. So that is in the state of ultimate reality. So there's a very nice verse, Srimad Bhagavatam 10:87-19. Svakritta vichitra yonishu vishan eva hetu taya taratmatas chakasi analavat svakritan tu kriti arta vitatasu amusu avitatam tavadhama samam virajadiyo nuyanti Obivi ponyava ekarasam. Ekarasam. Huh? Ekarasa means unchanging bliss. So the translation is, apparently entering among the variegated species of living beings you have created. You inspire them to act, manifesting yourself according to their higher and lower positions, just as fire manifests differently according to the shape of what it burns. Therefore, those of spotless intelligence, who are altogether free from material attachments, realize your undifferentiated, unchanging self to be the permanent reality among all these impermanent life forms. So, this is a very nice continuation of what was established in yesterday's class. You remember how Lord Krishna is the Otam Protam. He is the thread, the weave behind the design of existence. Huh? He is the basis, the unchanging basis of everything. He is the Sat, the eternal truth behind the Sat, in the other sense of the word Sat, which means this cosmic manifestation. He is the eternal form behind the temporary forms of this world. These temporary forms come and go, come and go, come and go. And that is because they come and go and return again because they're based on an eternal reality, an eternal form. Now, in this verse, we hear that that eternal reality is eternally blissful. Ekarasam. So, this material world, yes, is a place of dukkha. Why? Well, that is very easy to understand. Because here the forms are temporary. In Krishna, form is eternal. Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. Eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. So Krishna is the form behind all forms, the existence behind this material existence, and He is full of bliss. So from the purport, even in the midst of material creation and destruction, the Lord of all creatures remains eternally unchanged, as expressed here by the word ekarasam. In other words, the Lord eternally maintains His personal form of immeasurable, unalloyed spiritual pleasure. So Krishna says, I am the life of all that lives. Vishnu, the name Vishnu means He that exists everywhere, the all-pervading absolute truth. And He is ekarasam, He is full of bliss. So He is the ultimate truth. He is the life of all that lives. He is eternally blissful. That means the ultimate reality is this ekarasam, unchanging bliss. That is the truth. That is the fact. So, this already refutes Buddhism. But, nonetheless, we have joined this Krishna consciousness movement ourselves to get free of dukkha, to get free of suffering. So we are left to explain, all right, maybe the ultimate reality, we can accept that as being bliss, but we have been suffering until now. Now we have taken up Krishna consciousness to search out that unchanging bliss. So what is the cause of this perception of suffering? We still have to deal with this question. So that is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam. Here is a verse from Canto 11, Chapter 2, Text 37. An oft-quoted verse by Srila Prabhupada, which explains the cause of suffering. Bayam dvitiya binivesiyashat ishade pitasya vipariyo smriti tan mayato buddha abhijyatam bhaktyai kayesham guru deva atma. When the living entity is attracted by the material energy which is separate from Krishna, he is overpowered by fear. Because he is separated from the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the material energy, his conception of life is reversed. Very important. Vipariyo smriti. His conception of life is reversed. So reality is ekarasam. There is one unchanging, blissful nature. But when one becomes separated from Krishna due to association with the material energy, then Viparyosmriti, his conception of life is reversed, thus dukkha. So this is where Buddhism begins. Therefore, Buddhism is the first type of what we know as Mayavadi philosophy. There are two types, Srila Prabhupada says. The Saranath Mayavadis and the Varanasi Mayavadis. So, the Saranath Mayavadis, there's a place called Saranath, where there's a great number of Buddhist temples. So the Saranath Mayavadis, these are the Buddhists, and their philosophy is Maya. It is based on the principle of illusion. Therefore, their first principle is dukkha. There's nothing at all, nothing whatsoever spiritual about Buddhism. This is the first point we must understand. So, in other words, continuing with this translation, in other words, instead of being the eternal servant of Krishna, he becomes Krishna's competitor. This is called Viparyosmriti. To nullify this mistake, one who is actually learned and advanced worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his spiritual master, worshipful deity and source of life. He thus worships the Lord by the process of unalloyed devotional service. So, dukkha, suffering, begins with the misconception of thinking myself as being separate from Krishna. Thus, because I think myself separate from Krishna, as we hear from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 11, verses 5 through 8, Lord Krishna tells Uddhava, "Thus, my dear Uddhava, in the same material body, we find opposing characteristics, such as great happiness and misery. This is because both the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is eternally liberated, as well as the conditioned soul, are within the body. I will now speak to you about their different characteristics." Now this is very, 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 very important. Because the Buddhists say everything is full of suffering. Everything is suffering. That is the nature of existence. And yet they're trying to get out of suffering. Actually, in Buddhist terminology, when one is free of suffering, or when one ceases to exist, when one attains nirvana, they call that ananda. They do say that there is a blissful state, but that bliss is in not existing. But anyway, in their philosophy, there is this duality, as Lord Krishna here is saying. In the same material body, we find opposing characteristics, such as great happiness and misery. So now we are suffering, but we are desiring happiness. Everyone, whether they're Buddhist or whatever ist they may be, just gross materialist, rickshaw walla, whoever, whatever, philosophy or no philosophy, but this we see, that we are not satisfied with our present state of affairs. We're experiencing suffering, but we are hankering for something better. Now Krishna explains why that is so. Because within the same body, there is the jiva, who is thinking himself independent, and therefore he's suffering. But there's also the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Paramatma, who is full of bliss. And the jiva is eternally related with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is Ekarasa. Therefore the jiva has the intuition, whatever his philosophy may be, but he has the intuition that there is something better than this. He has that hope, he has that inspiration, or as we should say, aspiration. That there is a state beyond this state of suffering. Now how he proposes to attain that state, that is a different thing. There are those who propose to attain it by religion, you see, by attaining some heavenly state in the next life. There are those who think in this life, if I work in such and such way, make money, then I will become happy. So that's another question. But we see within everyone there is this fundamental duality. And so Krishna is explaining here why. Actually, everything is really bliss, ekarasam. But because the jiva has thought himself independent, therefore he's in duality. So now Krishna explains this duality further. And this is a very well-known example. By chance, two birds have made a nest together in the same tree. The two birds are friends and are of similar nature. One of them, however, is eating the fruits of the tree, whereas the other, who does not eat the fruits, is in a superior position due to his own potency. The bird who does not eat the fruits of the tree is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who by his omniscience perfectly understands his own position and that of the living entity, conditioned living entity, represented by the eating bird. That living entity, on the other hand, does not understand himself or the Lord. He is covered by ignorance and is thus called eternally conditioned, whereas the personality of Godhead, being full of perfect knowledge, is eternally liberated. And now, Lord Krishna explains enlightenment. Enlightenment is a term oft heard in Buddhism. And again, enlightenment to the Buddhist means simply to understand that I do not exist. But here, Lord Krishna says, one who is enlightened in self-realization, although living within the material body, sees himself as transcendental to the body, just as one who has arisen from a dream gives up identification with the dream body. A foolish person, however, although not identical with his material body but transcendental to it, thinks himself to be situated in the body, just as one who is dreaming sees himself as situated in an imaginary body. So again, actually, this is the Buddhist position. They're actually thinking, I am the body. And that's the problem. They're thinking, the problem is I exist. But that existence means the existence of the body to them. In other words, they're thinking, I am the body. The body exists, the body is myself, and that is the whole problem. So by meditation, I should attain nirodha, the extinction, the annihilation of the body, the final annihilation of the body, which will be the annihilation of myself. And then I will be happy. But no, Lord Krishna says, enlightenment and self-realization means to see oneself as distinct from the body. And that means to see one's eternal relationship with the Lord, who is in the heart, in the same tree of this body. So this is the Bhagavata explanation of both suffering and the freedom from suffering. Now, the Buddhists attempt to explain causation by giving the example of a wheel. This wheel, this symbol of a wheel, you'll see on the flag of India. On the flag of India, you see, this tricolor, green, white, and orange, I think. And in the white, the middle white field, there is a wheel. This is the Buddhist wheel of causation. Now, why in India, where there's less than 1% Buddhist, they have selected this symbol for their nation, I do not know. But, you know?
Gandhi originally had that wheel that he would spin the clock on. Oh. And then the bigger politicians thought this was a little too moral. So they just adapted it into this wheel of
time. Yeah. All right. Very good. So the Buddhist wheel of causation has 12 spokes. And these 12 spokes stand for different stages of existence. The first being avidya. So this is the first thing, avidya, ignorance. And then in the course of these 12, nama-rupa, this body, this mind, Krishna, material desires, jata-jara-marna, birth, old age, and death, and then again avidya. They revolve. So this is the Buddhist explanation of why things the way they are, the way they are. There is this wheel which is turning. Now the thing is, in Buddhist philosophy, there is no basis to anything. They do not exist, they do not accept any eternal basis of anything. In Buddhist philosophy, everything is simply always changing. But there is no what is known as substratum, or no eternal foundation. That is completely rejected in Buddhism. So to give the idea of how everything is simply always changing, they have this wheel. You see, the wheel that is always turning. And this is what existence is all about. So maybe to simple-minded people, this is a satisfactory example. But there is a big, big problem with it. Can anyone suggest what is the problem in this example? If there is no substratum. Yes?
First of all, the idea of the wheel, that is the substitute for the idea of that substratum. And who's turning the wheel? What's making the wheel turn?
Yeah. This is a good point. But what I want to focus on is that in a turning wheel, when a wheel is turning, there is something, there must be something that doesn't turn. What is that? The axle, yes. They give this example of a turning wheel, but any wheel that you see turning has to turn on an axle, and the axle does not move. So that's left out of the Buddhist philosophy. So therefore it breaks down, it becomes nonsense. Now Bhagavatam, there's a specific verse, which answers this problem. This is in Canto 8, Chapter 5, Text 28. I won't read the Sanskrit, just the translation. Now here, a wheel example is given. It is different, a bit different from the Buddhist wheel, but the general imagery of a changing wheel is the same. But just the aspects, the particular aspects of the wheel are explained differently in Srimad Bhagavatam. So in the cycle of material activities, the material body resembles the wheel of a mental chariot. The 10 senses, 5 for working and 5 for gathering knowledge, and the 5 life airs within the body form the 15 spokes of the chariot's wheel. The 3 modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, are its center of activities, in other words, the hub. And the 8 ingredients of nature, earth, water, fire, air, sky, mind, intelligence, and false ego, comprise the rim of the wheel. The external material energy moves this wheel like electrical energy. That's your answer to your question, what moves the wheel? It's the external material energy moving this wheel like electrical energy. Now this example goes back, that takes us back to the glance of the Supreme Lord. The glance of the Lord infuses the material nature, as you'll recall, with this energy, so that material nature in turn can act as the upadana karana. Material nature then is empowered to continue the process of creation after the Lord glances at her. So ultimately, even here, this electrical energy referred to ultimately goes back to the Lord. Thus, the wheel revolves very quickly around its hub or central support, the axle, which is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the Supersoul and the ultimate truth. We offer our respectful obeisances unto Him. So from the purport, the entire world is going on because the living entity, who is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, is utilizing the material energy. Under the clutches of the material energy, the Jivatma is revolving on the wheel of birth and death under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The central point is the Super Soul. And then a little later, in the same purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, "The material body of the living entity is the result of the conditioned soul's activities. And remember, this material body is explained here as a wheel. So this is the result of the conditioned soul's activities. And because the supporter is the super soul is a true reality. Again, ekarasam, and that true reality is bliss. Every one of us, therefore, should offer respectful obeisances to the central reality. We should not be misguided by the activities of this material world and forget the central point, the absolute truth. That is the instruction given here by Lord Brahma. So this one verse dispels the whole of the Buddhist idea of causation, of this wheel turning in space, this wheel that turns without any foundation. This is actually a senseless example. So, now, let us deal with the Buddhist conception of liberation. The Buddhist conception of liberation, or the means to obtain liberation, is nirodha. Nirodha means annihilation. So the Buddhist process of meditation is dedicated to annihilating existence. But this annihilation of our existence in this world, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, is not liberation. There is a specific verse which refutes this idea. In Canto 2, Chapter 10, Text 16, Nirodho syanusayanam atmana sahasyaktibi muktir hitvanyata rupam svarupena vivashtitaha. This verse explains what nirodha is and what liberation is, and they are not the same. So the translation is, the merging of the living entity along with its conditional living tendency within the mystic lying down of the Mahavishnu is called nirodha, or the winding up of the cosmic manifestation. So that is actually the Buddhist nirvana. The Buddhist nirvana is when everything winds up, dissolves, and enters back into the body of Mahavishnu. That state is called susupti. We actually have heard it previously, a verse which refers to this. Susupti is the state of total unconsciousness. And this is the state of pradhan. You've heard this verse spoken by Srila Shukadeva Goswami from the 10th canto, in which he describes the pradhan as shunyavat. It is like a void. So it is this pradhan state which is devoid of all consciousness. So the living beings, when they are merged into the body of Mahavishnu at the time of nirodha, devastation, they attain that shunyavat, that void state. But this is not liberation. Although this is what is desired by the Buddhists. How do we know that it's not liberation? Who can say? Very simple answer. Yes? Huh? All right, but that's not quite the answer I'm looking for. Yes? Yes. Because from out of that pradhan will again proceed, under the order of the Supreme Lord, the prakriti, the manifest material nature in the form of all the universe, and all these living entities will again attain bodies. Prabhupada said exactly where they left off. When the universe was dissolved previously, whatever state they were in, when the universe is recreated, that state they will attain again. So they'll begin right where they left off. So nirodha is no answer. Nirodha is not liberation. But the second two lines of this verse explain what liberation is. Muktir hidvanyata rupam svarupena vivashtiti. Liberation is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle bodies. So, mukti, to analyze this verse point by point, mukti hitvanyata You see? Hitva means to give up. Anyata means to take another, rupam. To give up this form, this material form, but to accept another, anyata. This other form means completely different form, or a form of completely different nature. In other words, to accept a transcendental form, spiritual form. Svarupena, that form is svarupa, your own form, the form of the soul. Vyavashtiti means permanent situation. That form is permanent, permanently situated in devotional service. So this is mukti. Not formlessness, but the appearance of the real form, the form of the soul, and the giving up of the false form, the material form. Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport, so after the winding up of the cosmic manifestation, most of the conditioned souls merge into the existence of the Mahavishnu personality of Godhead, lying in his mystic slumber, to be created again in the next creation. But some of the conditioned souls, who follow the transcendental sound in the form of Vedic literatures, and are thus able to go back to Godhead, attain spiritual and original bodies after quitting the conditional gross and subtle material bodies. So another verse on this point, explaining what is liberation, is from Canto 7, Chapter 7, Text 37. Translation. The real problem of life is the repetition of birth and death, which is like a wheel rolling repeatedly. This wheel, however, completely stops when one is in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, by the transcendental bliss realized from constant engagement in devotional service, one is completely liberated from material existence. All learned men know this. Therefore, my dear friends, O sons of the Asuras, immediately begin meditating upon and worshipping the Super Soul within everyone's heart. And then from the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, the cessation of all material happiness is called nivritti
or nirvana. So nirvana is a word used in Bhagavata philosophy, but just see how it is explained. Also, samsara is compared to a wheel. The Supreme Lord is the axle of that wheel. And just like the brake of a wheel is situated on the axle. So it's the Supreme Lord who can stop that wheel. And thus, one experiences, as Prahlad Maharaj says here, nirvana sukha. The Lord, who is behind the ever-changing material nature, is ekarasa. He is full of unchanging bliss. So when one takes shelter of the Lord and the Lord stops this wheel of repeated birth and death, then one attains nirvana sukha, or that same ekarasa. So that is the reality. So the whole Buddhist philosophy begins on a wrong principle, that everything is actually dukkha, suffering. That's wrong. This is Mayavadi philosophy. They're only dealing with Maya, illusion. They have not actually understood what is reality. So, it's now 11 o'clock. We could go on here, but I really don't want to, because the subject matters that we'll go into in the next class are rather deep. There are questions of perception, how we perceive, how the Buddhists say we perceive things, and how Bhagavata says we perceive, and so on. And there are a lot of verses which have to be gone over in order for us to understand the Bhagavata explanation of perception and the refutation, Bhagavata refutation, that reality is just hallucination, or that reality is just ultimately void. So I wanted to save that for the next class. So what we've heard today is a basic refutation of Buddhist ideas. So now we can open up for questions. Yes?
You're talking here about causation a lot, and I was thinking it's said that Krishna is the cause of all causes, but in one point I feel that the cause of this material world is the jivas, that I don't really sure if the jiva is the cause or Krishna is the cause, because the jiva is desire to come here.
Yes.
So,
yes,
actually,
yes, so that question is answered by a nice example Srila Prabhupada gave. Why are there prisons? So obviously the prison institution is a government department. It falls under government jurisdiction. But government does not want prisons. That's not considered a positive aspect of government. You'll never hear a politician campaigning on this, that if you elect me, I'm going to refurbish all the prisons and build more prisons and make them very, very nice. People aren't very inclined to vote for such things as that. If a politician says, I will decrease taxes, I will make more capital available for the people, and so on and so forth, then your life at home will become nicer. That is what brings votes. Not if he talks about rebuilding prisons and making them bigger or making them more modern. See, people are not very interested in that. This is not a very positive program of the government. But prisons are necessary. Why? Because there are criminals. So in that sense, you can say the prisons are there because of criminal desire of a certain class of people. But this class of people, they're not the ones who build the prisons. They're not the ones who sentence themselves to time in the prison. They're not the ones who determine whether they're in solitary confinement or in the light regime, you know, what state they're in within the prison, whether good prisoner or bad prisoner. Yes, that's a nice observation. They have created the need. It's the government that has to respond with the facility. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada would sometimes answer the question. Sometimes the question is posited in a challenging way. If Krishna loves us, then why did he create this material world in which we suffer? And Prabhupada would answer that question. Krishna did not create this material world. You did, in that sense, that you created the need. Another example is of a little girl who sees her mother cooking, and she insists, "Mommy, I want to cook. I also want to cook supper like you're doing." And the mother says, "Now you're just a little girl, you know. You cannot cook. This is very dangerous. I'm working over a hot stove. One can get burned." No, mommy, I want to cook." So the little girl insists and she begins to cry. So to make her happy, mother brings a toy stove. You see, in the shops they sell these little toy stoves and toy pots and pans. And so then the little girl can very happily go out in the backyard with her toy stove and make mud pies and put them in the oven and things like that. And she's very happy. Now I'm cooking. But this is just play acting. It's like the material world. We want to be God, Vipariyo Smriti. We want to be God. And God says, you cannot be God. No, I want to be God. All right. Another example is very similar. The child wanting to hold the moon. I want to hold the moon. You can't hold the moon. No, no, I want the moon. So then the intelligent mother gives the child a mirror. So you just hold the mirror in such a way and the moon will be in your hand. And the foolish child is very happy. Ha 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 ha. I'm holding the moon. So it's in this way that the Supreme Lord gives the facility for the living entity to act out their illusory desire to become God. It's actually, in that sense, it is this material world is a kind of fantasy. It's a kind of playground world. Yeah. The constitutional position of ultimate happiness, the beginning of it is Brahman, because impersonal Brahman is the absence of suffering. So when the jiva, whether the jiva is trying to merge into Brahman or like the devotees, the jiva is passing through the Brahman effulgence on the way to the spiritual world. When the jiva touches Brahman, the Brahma Jyoti, he begins to experience his constitutional happiness of his eternal nature. But Krishna says, Brahmano hi pratishtaham, I am the basis. So there is sukha, Brahma sukha. There is happiness in Brahman. That is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. But this happiness is compared to the water that is held within the footprint of a calf as compared to the happiness of the Supreme Lord, Bhagavan, Premananda. This happiness is called, that's called Brahmananda. And the happiness of love of God is called Premananda. And this ocean of love of Godhead is, yes, like the unlimited Karana Jal, unlimited, without, you cannot find the shore as compared to the water of the same bliss. It is spiritual bliss, but that water is held within the footprint of a calf. So the living entity, just upon liberation, just upon attaining the Brahman state, he attains his position of happiness. But that happiness deepens and deepens and deepens more and more, the more connected he becomes in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So therefore Krishna says, I am the basis. I am the basis of that Brahmananda. Well, the supreme personality of God is, in whatever form, is Sakshidananda Vigraha. But as Srila Prabhupada explains, in the Lord's manifestation, there is perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. So when we speak of the personality of God, it's Vishnu Tattva. You're beginning with perfection, perfect happiness. I'm not quite sure what you're trying to get at here. But it is, yes, the rays of the Brahma Jyoti emanating from the body of Lord Narayan are blissful. But if we don't go beyond simply those rays, then you see there's no relationship between those rays. So therefore, as Srila Prabhupada says, or Bhagavatam says, Aruya Krishna Prabhupadam Tara Padanti Yadho Nadata Yushma Ranangraya. The living entity who attains only the impersonal Brahman will eventually fall down. Because although there is bliss there, that bliss is only bliss in the sense of the absence of suffering. He is understanding himself to be eternal, free from old age, disease and death, so therefore he's blissful. But his desires for knowledge and his desires for loving exchange, knowledge means knowledge of form, quality, activity, and knowledge of loving exchange, which is actually ananda, same ananda. They cannot be satisfied in the Brahma-jyotra. So therefore, his unfulfilled desires will cause him to be attracted again by the name, form, quality, and relationships within Maya, in the material world. So there is bliss, but it is only partial bliss. Yes?
Can a Buddhist exist in an enlightened state?
What a Buddhist
state? He's enlightened and he won't exist.
Yeah, well, to them, nirvana means to cease to exist. Niroda.
How can anyone teach?
Well, that is the contradiction of Mayavadi philosophy. That is the contradiction of Vyakrita. Vyakrita means the truth cannot be expressed. Shankaracharya's philosophy is just a further development of Buddhism. And the same thing is there also. That in Shankara's formulation, there's what they call Vyavaharika, which is conventional truth or practical truth. Vyavaharika Satya. What is that? That is the teaching of Shankaracharya. And the process the Mayavadi philosophers follow. Vyavaharika Satya, conventional truth, but that is not ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is called Paramartika Satya, and that cannot be expressed. So therefore, you know, this is the contradiction of Mayavadi philosophy. They're talking so many things, but that very talk itself is actually Maya. Yes?
Is it possible to merge into Brahman Deity without worshipping Krishna? What would be the destination of those Buddhists who are supposed to be self-realized?
You can worship Guna Avatar form of Krishna, like Brahma or Shiva. Both can award a situation in the Brahman effulgence. That is confirmed in Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a verse which confirms that by worship of Lord Brahma, one can attain the Brahma Jyoti. And also, there's a verse which explains that Lord Shiva awards liberation into the impersonal Brahman. But this is not real liberation. It's not permanent, no. Therefore, Lord Shiva, there's this verse, I'm just trying to think of it. Someone know that verse? Liberation is awarded by Lord Vishnu. Anyone know that? Muktirevana Sansaya Dhanas. Anyway, I don't quite remember it. But Lord Shiva says, those who aspire for real liberation, permanent realization of their eternal spiritual position, they must worship Lord Vishnu without a doubt. Not sansaya, without a doubt.
So, how come in, I think one purpose, Prabhupada says, that 99% of Buddhists have no chance of going to Vaikuntha, but this way it's just open that one promil might go, so how come?
99.9% of what?
Of the so-called liberated Buddhists fall back.
Liberated Buddhists, or you mean impersonal?
Yeah, impersonal.
Yeah, there's a difference.
Because they have no no information about the white pointer.
Yes. Someone asked the question about Lord Shiva, and I explained how Lord Shiva is situated within the rays of Brahman. So he is Krishna's devotee. So a few of these mystics who are very devoted to Lord Shiva and who are inclined to associate with him rather than just be one with the rays of Brahman, then by associating with Lord Shiva, they're instructed further in devotional service. And they may go from the impersonal Brahman state into Vaikuntha by his mercy, because Vaishnavanam Yatha Shambhu, he is a great Vaishnava. Mostly those who worship Lord Shiva, they're impersonalists. Srila Prabhupada always said, when he was asked, some scholar asked him, the Shaivites, they're worshipping the personal form of Shiva, so do you accept them as also personalists? And Srila Prabhupada said, no, they are impersonalists, because their goal is to merge, become one with the impersonal Brahman. They worship Shiva to attain that goal. But some become actually attached to the association, the personal association of Lord Shiva. So by his association, they become bhaktis of Lord Vishnu. Yeah? Yeah, well, in Buddhism they have the concept of bodhisattva. That's like the term sattva, note of goodness or pure. That's a Buddhist who has attained a very, very high state, but he's still within the body. So he's within the body to preach Buddhism. So they say the bodhisattvas, they're maintaining the body only for that purpose. So they're almost completely liberated. And the only reason they're not completely liberated is due to compassion rather than lust. No, it must be done to maintain the body. Well, as I said, the bodhisattvas, they keep the body. Actually, they stay within samsara to preach. Yeah, well, he has to break down not only the gross aspects of the body, but the subtle, because mind is also understood in Buddhism as subtle material energy. So that must be broken down. So that all has to be done by meditation. Finally, the sense of I has to be broken down. So therefore, the body has to be maintained during meditation to accomplish all this. Yeah, that when their realization is perfect, then the functions of the body stop. Everything stops. So they become monks. That's the way in Buddhism you escape karmic reaction. You become a monk and you follow the 243 regulative principles of a Buddhist monk. There's something like 243. But if you follow all these principles, then you are free of karma. Otherwise, unless you're a sannyasi or a monk, all you can do is give in charity to the monks and you get some good karma. But there's no question of liberation.
So in Buddhist society, you see the Buddhist householders, they're very eager to give in charity to monks. Therefore, in some, like in Malaysia, the Hare Krishna devotees, they go out because the Chinese people think that they're Buddhist monks. So it's very good on Sankirtan. Just go to the Chinese and hold out your cloth like this and immediately get all kinds of donations, and then you give them a book on the terms. You don't even have to offer the book, you just hold out the cloth and immediately they give.
I'm thinking in terms of picking in the wet and being able to get the
but they still.
Yeah, well, these people, that everything is in the mind. You see, the Western philosophy, and that's why the Westerners like Buddhism, because they're completely mental. They think everything is in the mind. Liberation is in the mind. If I just feel good in the mind, everything's okay. So they like to contemplate Buddhist philosophy, you know, that everything is actually nothing. This Zen Buddhism is very popular for that reason. Everything is actually nothing, but somehow here I am anyway. And they think by thinking about that, that they're actually free, actually liberated. But that's not even according to Buddhist, the real Buddhist philosophy itself. Even Zen Buddhism is very, very rigorous. The original Zen Buddhist was an Indian monk named Bodhidharma, who went to China, and he sat in a cave, and he was just staring at a wall for 12 years. That was his meditation. And because he became sleepy staring at the wall, which is not a very interesting meditation, he cut off his own eyelids so that his eyes wouldn't close. And he was just staring at this wall for 12 years. And there was one Chinese fellow who lived in the village below. And this monk became very famous because, you know, this Indian monk has come, he's gone in the cave, he's just staring at the wall and doing nothing else for year after year. So this Chinese boy was coming and begging at the monk's feet, please accept me as your disciple. And the monk would not even pay any attention to him, would not acknowledge the Chinese person who was trying to serve him in so many ways, and the monk was just staring at the wall. Finally, the Chinese boy, he cut off his own arm and he laid it before the monk. And then the monk accepted it. All right, you have what it takes to practice Zen Buddhism. You know, now Zen Buddhism is some kind of, you know, tea parlor. Even meditation, you know. I remember, because before I became a devotee, I took some classes in Zen Buddhism, taught by some beatnik poet. It was just ridiculous, you know. So this is what you see in the West is not even, I mean, they've taken something from Buddhist philosophy, but it's just a typical Western lazy mental speculation, that's all. Thinking everything can be attained through the mind. But in all the forms of Indian, coming from India, the Indian forms of discipline, yoga, even Buddhism, what to speak of the Vedic tradition, the mind is known to be conquered when the senses are controlled, even in Buddhism. Yes, the mind, yes, Buddhism means to control the mind or conquer the mind or enlighten the mind. But that is seen, that is the proof of that is when the senses stop their functions of sense gratification. Therefore, whether you're talking about Vaishnava, talking about Advaitis, Mayavadi, Shankara, or even Buddhist, those who are perfect in the discipline are the sannyasis, those who renounce everything. They're all, in each case,
Sannyasi is understood to have actually grasped the true meaning of the doctrine, because he is renounced. He has stopped all sense gratification. But in the West, they just think everything's in the mind only. It doesn't matter what the senses are doing. You can do any nonsense. And then Srila Prabhupada said, now, unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, it's the Indians who are learning, copying from the West. Therefore, when Vivekananda went to America, he was offered beef and wine. And he first said, because he'd been lecturing, so those people who were making these offerings, they had heard his philosophy. And he was saying, well, you know, actually I'm a sannyasi. Sannyasi shouldn't take these things. And so the Westerners who had heard him preach, they said, but why? You say everything is Brahman. So beef and wine is also Brahman. And he said, yeah, very good. You have understood. All right, let me take it. So Prabhupada said, he went to America to learn the fine art of eating meat and drinking wine and giving some spiritual excuse for it. Everything is Brahman. Yes. Well, one has to establish that spiritual life begins with understanding I am not the body. Even in Buddhism, I mean, they're thinking I am the body and therefore bodily existence must stop. So the point is that spiritual life begins with the understanding I am not the body. Activities of bodily sense gratification must stop. So now the question is how you will do that. What is the best process for doing that? And practically, one can just see practically the Krishna consciousness process is not only the best process, it's the only process that will actually stop sense gratification. Yes? Well, if they worship Lord Buddha as God, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has pointed out that the nature of the living being being what it is, we are naturally theistic. So although Buddhist is an atheistic philosophy, commonly you see Buddhists, they worship Buddha as God. I've seen myself, I visited Burma, Mandalay, there's a very famous temple of the Buddha called the Mahamuni Pagoda. And this particular image of Buddha, the Buddhists all say, they themselves say, this image is the Buddha. At least this particular one, they insist, because it's growing every year. The growth is due to the fact that people come and they press gold foil on it, so it's getting bigger and bigger. But amazingly, it's growing in proportion. You see, in perfect proportion. So this is considered miraculous because no one is telling the people where to press the foil. So somehow it's just growing in perfect proportion. So anyway, they have this idea that the deity of this particular form of Buddha, in this pagoda, is Buddha himself. And so they worship Buddha as God here. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, that's the natural tendency, even if the religion is atheistic in philosophy. The tendency is to accept the prophet or the messiah or the originator of the religion as God and to worship him. So those who worship Buddha as God, then they are actually worshipping Krishna. Indirectly. When Srila Prabhupada was told about a Buddhist sect in Japan which was making offerings to the deity of Buddha. They were making offerings of fruit and taking that fruit afterwards and offering prayers and so on. Srila Prabhupada said that, then they are Vaishnavas. So that is the benefit. The benefit is not from the philosophy. But the benefit is just in this simple devotion to Buddha. Because he's Vishnu. Yeah? Well, that was said. How true that is, because this Western philosophy is very subjective. I mean, the business of philosophers is to disagree with one another, and the differences of teachers of different schools of philosophy, they disagree among themselves in the other school. That's their business. Well, you'll get some general idea of the philosophy, but more importantly, you'll see how Prabhupada refutes it. But even if you go to university and hear from a seeming representative of Western philosophy or a particular school of Western philosophy, you'll find that his position is opposed to someone else's in the same discipline. They argue between themselves, so it's very subjective. Yes, yes, it is an eternally reoccurring doctrine. As I've tried to show here, it's actually a product of the psychology of the mind. So therefore, we see the same basic standpoints are there in Western philosophy too. For instance, there's this philosopher, David Hume, English philosopher. So he's a voidist philosopher. And you read his arguments. They are very similar to the arguments of the Sunyavadi Buddhists. So anyway, I don't want to get into this in much detail, but these ideas are simply functions of the mind. So they're naturally recurring anyway. So what the Buddha does, Lord Buddha is Krishna's form of mercy to the atheist. He comes and he preaches some philosophy which is actually contradictory. Actually, Lord Buddha, that was the thing that was pointed out by different persons hearing him, that in one lecture you say this, in another lecture you say the opposite. What are you really saying? So for Buddha himself, philosophy was not important. He just came to preach to the atheists to get them to control their senses, stop killing animals, follow him. Unless they would be benefited. For him, the philosophy was not really the important thing.
Like Krishna in the fourth chapter, telling Arjuna that knowledge I give you, I already spoke to the sun god, who was supposed to be the speech for the deep that you know it. Give us the third person to the sun god. So, for the first one, to send
yeah, the basic ahimsa, shunyata, that's the thing. But one, you see, to arrive at this conclusion, one doesn't require Buddhism, actually. For instance, the Jains, the Jain philosophy, another Indian teaching, very similar to Buddhism. And as I said, there's Western philosophers, which taught very similar things also. But the fact is that Buddha is Krishna. So when he comes, he can say whatever he likes. Any damn thing.
But if they follow him, they're following Krishna. That's the point. If they worship him, they get benefit of worshiping Krishna. If they worship some nonsense, you know, ordinary atheist, there's no benefit at all.
Yes? Is it classified as empirical?
Yeah, it's empirical in the negative sense. That's the negation. Empirical means based on the senses, sense perception. So generally the word empirical is used in connection, you know, to indicate like Western science. But the negation of it, Prabhupada in his purports often uses the word empirical to refer to jnanis who negate the material world, because they're just negating the information of the senses. So that is also empirical, but in a negative sense. Yes?
I remember that the Buddhists themselves are this cost of four different Buddhas who appear in different times. So do you know if this refers to different yogas? And first, if there are different incarnations of called Buddha?
Yes, the Bhagavatam confirms Buddha appears in the Kali Yugas. There is a Buddha described in Srimad Bhagavatam who preached to the Asuras who were attacking other planets. So that was in another Kali Yuga. In other Puranas, you find that this Buddha was actually preaching to those Asuras who are flying in those three cities. These are the spaceships that are being referred to. There's the three cities which Lord Shiva destroyed. Therefore Lord Shiva has the name Tripurari. So there was a form of Buddha who appeared to preach to the demons in those three cities, flying cities. And there are many other Buddhas, and that is also accepted by the Buddhists themselves.
Is there any book or chapter or teaching that Buddhism is based on philosophy?
Well, they have many books.
Yes, not by Lord Buddha.
No, nothing is written by Lord Buddha. In fact, the interesting thing is that nothing in Buddhism was written down until about 300 years after Lord Buddha. Everything was kept in the memory. But after 100 days after Buddha's disappearance, they started to argue about what Buddha said. One person remembered one way, another remembered another way, and they started to argue. And these arguments went on for 300 years until Maharaj Ashok finally said, all right, write it down. So whatever they remembered after 300 years, that was written down. So it's very similar to Christianity, the teachings of Jesus Christ. Nothing, he didn't write anything down. And nothing was, the Christian Bible, well, it was written down, but one book here, one book there, and there are many, many other books that are not included in the modern Bible. And 400 years after Christ, Augustine, he compiled the modern Bible by just taking different books, looking at them, and, well, this doesn't look very good, throw it out. Well, I don't like this. Well, this is all right. So the Bible is actually a creation of an ordinary man, Augustine, not Jesus Christ. Similarly, the Buddhist scriptures, you know, they didn't emanate directly from Buddha. Yes?
Just on this line, I mean, I've often had this said to me, how could we conclusively establish to somebody on the street or something that the Bhagavad Gita that I'm holding in my hand is the original Gita with the words of it?
Well, one answer is that the proof is in the pudding, or the proof of the pudding is in the eating. That the Bhagavad Gita are instructions for becoming Krishna conscious, and if we follow Bhagavad Gita as it is taught by the bona fide representative of Bhagavad Gita, we become Krishna conscious. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said, Bhagavad Gita was available in the West, but it was not presented by devotee. Therefore, no one became devotee from reading these other Bhagavad Gita. So these actually were not the Bhagavad Gita. These other editions of Bhagavad Gita, although in terms of the words of the verses, they're the same, but the understanding is different. Therefore, these other editions are not Bhagavad Gita as it is, but rather Bhagavad Gita as we are. You see, Bhagavad Gita according to our own conception. The second answer is that evam parampara praptam. There is an unbroken guru parampara. Or four bona fide sampradayas down which Bhagavad Gita has been handed till the present day. There was no printing presses in India even 1,000 years ago. What to speak of 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years ago. Why is it universally the Bhagavad Gita is the same? Because of Guru Parampara. Because spiritual masters were actually devoted to their predecessor spiritual masters, and they handed down the knowledge without changing it. Bhagavad Gita was written on banana leaves, bound together by banyan roots. You see, in this village and that village, you know, here and there. So, where was the quality control? How is it that Bhagavad Gita from some village in northern India is the same as Bhagavad Gita in South India or wherever? These Brahmins weren't consulting one another by telephone. This is due to Guru Parampara.
And even the Mayavadi translations of Bhagavad Gita, is Sanskrit the same?
Yes. Because they just took from the Vaishnavas and put their own purport.
May I just make a comment? You're just saying how the proof is in the eating of the pudding, but we could also see, for instance, you were saying how the Bible was just compiled by an ordinary person. Yet it has produced many people who have given up their life.
Yeah, well, it's not that the Bible is totally without merit.
Is an argument valid in this
context? Well, we're talking about proof of the absolute truth. Bhagavad Gita is presenting, Srila Prabhupada says Bhagavad Gita is distinct from all other religious scriptures because it's spoken by God himself. So the Bible elevates people to a higher standard of life from gross sins to relatively morally good life. That's what the Bible does, so that one may attain heaven. But there's no question of attaining liberation.